Okay, so Hechsher Kalim. Right. We talked about Tefillah Kalim. Now, let's be straightforward about this. Hechsher Kalim. The sugya is long enough that it should take us longer than the number of days we have left in the year when you take into account Shavuos. And even if you don't take into account Shavuos.
Are you here for Shavuos?
I'm not here for Shavuos. So, there's... Yeshiva is over a week from today.
Yeah.
So, we will do what we can on this sugya. But do not think that we have exhausted everything on the sugya. Okay? So, because we're short on time, so I want to... I think highlight some of the fundamental points in this sugya. Okay, so let us for a moment talk about the sugya outside. So the Gemara notes that, as we talked about when we were doing Tefillah Kalim, the way the Gemara understands the requirements of the parsha by Klei Midyan, right after the Milchama, is that it's talking about Klei Suda. It's talking about. You're talking about.
The paradigm.
No, not.
Oh no!
Right. Remember, we talked about this, right? That in Prat you could have read the whole thing about being paraduma, about being tumat meit, or some added tumat akum or something. But Chazal understand at least these psukim, the ones we've read over and over again, right? Achara zaha vera kesef vera etc.
Right.
Kol asher yavo ba'esh etc. That it's about koshering, meaning. That which came into contact with not kosher food, if one wants to kosher it, if one wants to use it, one must kosher it. And at least the substances mentioned in the Gemara, in the Psukim rather, in the Psukim are kosherable, and certain things are not at all kosherable, like cheres, like pottery. Certain things are machloket, obviously, that's not surprising. Good. Okay. Now, the Gemara therefore says there are two main ways of koshering. What are they?
Agala and libud.
Agala and libud. Good. What is the difference?
Boiling water and flame.
Water versus
flamethrower.
Flamethrower. Great. And what types of things need the flamethrower?
Grill things, spits.
Grill spits things that were contact where the contact between the food and the vessel takes place. Where the medium directly is fire, right? Is that a fair way of saying it?
Okay.
Right? Is that a fair way of saying it? Right. Meaning.
So is that how we can say like that same stuff?
That's why like a pot is not use. What?
Because I learned this in Ginsburg's series. We learned it as like anything used over an open fire. So that brought up the question, like, well, how does like pots and pans work? Because at least most things nowadays have. Flames that...
Exactly, and that's right, and that's why it is incorrect to say that which is used over an open fire, because obviously a pot is also over an open fire. What it means is that the medium between the food and the pot, right, is directly fire.
Right.
Right? Now, I'm being a bit ambiguous there, because it's not 100% true that what I just said is correct. There is a middle case.
That's pretty correct.
Well, the question is frying pans. Right, frying pans are a bit of a machlokes.
Frying pans, you use oil.
So that's the question in Psak, is does the fact that you use a little bit of oil, is that sufficient to call it... Yes, but is it sufficient? Right, meaning there's a difference, obviously, between... Like, I'm not talking like a deep fryer, necessarily. I'm talking like, right, where there's a little bit of oil. Right, like, think about it. When you just use... When you, like, just use, like, enough oil to make it not stick, right, is that really a medium, right, or is that... Basically, al ha'esh, right? And that's why there's a machlok to post, and that's why frying pans in general are more machmir.
Again, usually you do like a little bit of oil, and then usually it's substituted with the moisture of the food.
Exactly, but that's why there's a machlokas, right? The reason that frying pans are somewhere in the middle is because.
But most time it's usually liquid.
Depends how much, right? Again, if you just use like oil spray.
Right,
that's what I'm saying, right? Or a little bit of oil, right? Sure, if you deep fry something.
If not for the spray, I don't think it would have been that much of a machlokas.
I don't know. You know, so when you just grease a pan, right? It's not like Anyways, but this is we're not necessarily going to get to all the sugyas, so I'm going to, as we learn through, throw some things out so you know they exist. If we have time to come back to sort of pratim, we will. If not, at least you can't accuse me of not at least, you know, making you aware of the fact that this exists. Okay.
Right.
But like I say, the paradigmatic case, right, if we just want to make it easy, is like, yeah, pots, right, where, you know, you cook chicken soup, right? That's a pot that needs hagalah. And a spit needs libun, okay? A barbecue needs libun.
Right.
Right. Now, there are interesting middle cases, what we call libun kal, right? And again, that's, we'll see if we have time to get in libun kal, right? Where it's, but that's, those are the two categories that the Gemara raises, okay? Now, the Gemara has a problem. Right, the Gemara has a problem, which is the assumption of kashering is what? What are you kashering from?
The treifness.
Good, thank you. Beautiful word, the treifness. Right, the treifness. So the Gemara says, but there's a problem. Why? Because there is a category in halacha known as notein atam lifgam. Right, where the taste that is absorbed is now
stuck in the metal,
is now ichi, right? Is now lufkam. It now is right, not a good taste. So the Gemara at right notes that there is a shita which we paskin like, which is that notain tam lufkam is mutar. Right, that once the taste is spoiled, is spoiled, whatever. The taste is no longer relevant halachically. Thus, right, if a kli is eno ben yomo, if a kli has not been used in
several years, 4 hours.
No. So be careful, okay. Right? Tosfos notes this is a machlokas, right? That the way we paskin is it hasn't been used in 24 hours. The Rashi thinks ben yomo simply means it has not been used since sunrise. Right, meaning as long as a night has gone by, whether or not it's 24 hours, the taste is now lifgam. Right, that's Rashi's position. Again, some of these issues we'll manage to get back to, some of them we won't. Okay, but let's just sort of get it out there. The Gemara's problem is that since we paskin that way, that a kedera which is not ben yomo, a pot which is not ben yomo, can no longer trafe something up, with the possible exception of when there is a davar harif, right, which is something you should just know halachal maisa. I don't think we're going to get to davar harif. Right, but the reason that most shilas come up are about onions and garlic are because this rule doesn't apply
to shum
or batzel or to Shabbos. Any... Shabbos. I mean, the classic case of davar charif is chiltis, which is, in English, asafotida.
Both of those words are gibberish. What the heck did you say?
It is a spice from the Near East. It's used extensively in Indian cooking. Its nickname is also devil's dung. If you have it it has all types of wonderful nicknames. Because if you have it diluted, it will literally burn a hole in your stomach lining.
Really?
What?
Yes.
And they use this in food.
Oh yeah, it's class. It's very much used in Indian cooking.
How do they still have population trouble if they have something that literally burns you from the inside out?
Right. Now I don't have. But it's once it's cooked and processed or whatever, it's fine. Okay. So the Gemara therefore says, but if that's the case, why does one ever need to kasher anything? Right? Don't you only have to kasher something if you want to use it within 24 hours? Right? Once it's not ben yomo, the not kosherness in the kli can't do anything. Right? So what's the Gemara's answer?
Sometimes this person wants to use the same thing. Can.
What's his answer? Come on, guy.
Because he might come to use it.
Good. Right? Gzeira. Right? Eino ben yomo mishum ben yomo. Right, because we're worried to use it in the same day. So I want to just make one very important point, okay? This is the point that the Rav makes, and I think is one of the key points to understand this sugya. I don't know why the Rav was the first one to articulate this clearly. He wasn't, actually. But he articulated most clearly. There is another sugya. Okay? There is a machloket in the Gemara regarding what is called known as ta'am ki ikar. Right?
Primary taste.
No, whether taste is ki ikar, is like the primary.
Like the primary?
Right, meaning this notion that the taste that is imparted from a pot into food prohibits the food, even though that which is prohibited is not present. Right? Tam, ki ikar, that the taste of a prohibited substance is as prohibited as the substance itself. Right?
I don't get it. This whole thing of tam, the giving tam. I thought we were just concerned about that. I thought we were more concerned about the substance rather than the taste of the substance.
So that's right. What we learn from this is not the case, right? The fact that something that is cooked in a not kosher pot, even the not kosher food is not present, right? That it can trafe up the food, right? That's based on this notion of tam, of transference of taste, right? Most of the halachos of kashrus are complicated because of this notion of tam. Right, of tam transferring, right, of taste transferring, and that's why we have so much time spent on principles like you saw at the bottom of the Gemara here, of notin tam lifgam, right, that the only type of tam that is problematic is what's called notin tam lishvach, right, is a good taste, but if the taste is rancid, right, meaning it's even the taste that is absorbed in the walls of the vessel is already, you know, a few days old, and therefore whatever taste it will impart into your food will be ich, right? So then we say, halachically, notin lam of gam is mutter, because the transference of taste is the transference of a
good taste.
Bad taste. In notin lam of gam is a bad taste, and therefore not relevant. Now, there is a machloket about whether this principle of tam is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, right? Whether this is true biblically, right, that the taste of pig will now prohibit your corn. I don't know. I don't know. I don't care. Pick it. You want something else? Your pig will trade up
your potatoes.
Yeah, who cares? I love it. It's like, oh, the kashas on the example you get. I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Didn't have to change it. Would say it's a kasha on the mindset.
It's not even a kasha on the mindset. It's a kasha on a theoretical that I just threw out. Right?
What I know from biblical...
You're like, why pig on corn? Why not shellfish on broccoli? I don't know. It could be shellfish on broccoli. I don't care. Right?
Yeah, I don't care.
It could be anything. It could be camel on... Right, on ice cream. I don't care. It makes no difference to me. Right? Come whatever you want. No difference to me. Yeah, okay. I'm with AB on this one. Ugh. Okay. Now, ask me a question. Okay. Ask me a question. Once you introduce this notion of tam ki ikar and the possibility that tam ki ikar is loved araisa, that it's only rabbinic, not biblical, ask me a huge question on kashering.
What do you do? A suffix case.
No, bigger question. Ask me a bigger question.
Repeat what you said. We have a question.
Right, knowing that there is a machlokes of whether tam ki ikar, this notion that taste is as prohibited as the substance itself.
As the
thing itself, right? As the pig itself, the taste of the pig is as prohibited as the pig. Right, there is a machloket. Tam ki ikar d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. Is that biblical or rabbinic? Right, now ask me a problem. Based on, right, the Gemara I just mentioned, ask me a big problem. Come on. Think about it, right?
From what I remember biblically, it just said, don't eat this animal, period.
The Gemara has koshering, remember? The Gemara understands the psukim of... Right, everything goes through fire, passes through fire, then goes through water, passes through water. Right, that's koshering. Now, what's the problem? Right,
no,
you're almost there.
The Torah doesn't mention Tom. It just talks about.
But let's assume Tom. Right, meaning let's say where they get from Tom. They get it from different places. One is from Nazir, right? From this week's part, from Mishrat.
Right.
But come on, ask me a big kasha.
You're passing through fire. Will there still be taste on it?
This is only if you assume.
So then
we're talking about
kashrus. Thank you. Wait, no. No. Come on. You guys can do this. Right? I want to give you the sources on this, but it's more important for me to get the Gemara, but I think this is a fundamental principle you need to understand in kashrus.
So
which is the following. If you hold the tam ki ikar d'oraisa, then the halacha of kashering is coherent. Right? It's coherent. Why is it coherent? Because you say that the taste of something prohibited is also prohibited, and therefore one must expunge it from the pot, lest it do what? Lest it make the next thing you cook in there not kosher by imparting taste.
Okay.
Right, now move to our Gemara, and the Gemara says, wait a second, that's only true within 24 hours, but after 24 hours, it's not going to do anything. Right, the taste is?
Gone.
Is gone. Well, let's assume for a moment gone. Or not halakhically significant, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And the Gemara says, you're right. But we tell you to kosher even eino ben yomo, so you don't end up using it within ben yomo. Even more fundamental.
So if we're only worried about the taste, then why don't we just wash it with some water and be
what's even more fundamental? Come on.
Because you said to pass it through fire, and even though...
If you hold tam ki ikar lav d'oraita...
Oh, then boiling would be fine.
Then you wouldn't even need to kosher.
So I was thinking...
Right? Think about it. Right? If you hold that biblically taste is not a relevant category. I mean, tam ki ikar lav d'oraita...
You just have to wash it with soap and water or something.
Correct, like, but what's the problem with saying that?
And you just, what it's
then
like,
we wouldn't have the psukim for...
Yeah, the problem is that koshering comes from the psukim.
Right.
Right? This is the big problem. Is if you hold... Right, how can there be a position in the universe... The tam ki ikar lav d'oraita. The taste is irrelevant halachically on a biblical level. If we know that there is a halacha from the Torah called koshering. Right? This is a problem. Right? Right? This is a big problem.
It's obvious in the Torah. Even just talking about what not to eat, it doesn't talk about you can't have the taste of this, because it talks about also in the Torah of like God giving us certain substances that taste like this, like giving us alternatives to prohibited substances. So it's obviously not the taste; it's the substance itself.
No, but tell me. But okay, but no, okay, but now, but now, tell me, right? So that, I mean, does this problem not bother you? Right, this problem should bother you, right? Which is, right, we have two facts on the ground. That there are shitot who think that taste is not problematic biblically, right? Mere taste is not problematic biblically, and yet...
You still have laws of kashrut.
We have the laws of kashering, not kashrut, of kashering.
Kashering.
Right, of kashering, and the Gemara never asks... Right, in our Gemara, what did the Gemara say? Wait a second, after 24 hours, or after the night, however you understand, in Rashi Tosos, right, the taste is now rancid, it's now lefgam. So why do you ever need koshering? Gemara's answer is?
You don't need it.
It's a gzera, right, that's only derabanan, right? But the Gemara never says, right, we don't ever have anyone say, but wait a second, right, if taste... If the notion that taste makes something problematic is itself dirabanan, then why do you have halacha of kashering at all? Right? What is this thing? Right? If you hold tam ki ikar lav d'oraisa, why should you ever kosher?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Good. What has to be the answer? There's, as far as I can tell, only one plausible answer to this, which is...
Theoretical.
Wouldn't be, no.
Thank you. The only answer is there can't be such a shita. No, there is such an answer, right? There is such an answer. Good. So now what? You're like, the only answer is that's such a good question that there must be no answer, so we must possibly the other shita.
How is
right? That's a great way of going about it, but let's try actually solving this problem.
Maybe it's how he's punished.
Well?
If he forgot, then... He would, picking up that the Bnei Tam is not transferred, didn't transfer because it was over a day period, and he forgot to just kosher it.
If we went by Tam, that would open up so many holes.
We do go by Tam.
Yeah.
We do. This is Tam ki ikar.
You can't have the Tam of something else. Oh,
correct.
Maybe it's an added thing.
That's undeniable. We do pass get Tam ki ikar.
Have we ever had any, alternatives to all these other things? Like, for instance... fake bacon or this or
that's not that's the Tom
fish brain that was
no because that's not the Tom of something usher. It just tastes like something usher, but that's different.
The Tom of something usher.
No, it's the Tom like something usher, not the Tom from something usher. Tom kikar is the taste from something usher.
From the pig, not like it.
Right, not like it, from it.
Taste may be just...
Right, meaning the derivative of actual pig taste now is now absorbed into the walls of the pot. That is usher. Right, not the Gemara in Zivak celebrates the fact that there is nothing in the world, right? Yalta has her famous drasha in Chulin.
That's what I was talking about.
Correct. You're correct, right? So you have to be more precise. It doesn't mean the taste similar to that which is usher. It means... The taste derived directly from that which was usher, right? Meaning,
right.
That's what we mean by tam kikar, right? But now, so come on, tell me, what if you don't want to just take the easy way out, like Nachum, and say, I don't believe you that there is such another shita. There is no shita. The tam kikar lav daraisa, because there is such a shita. So I mean, deal with it, right?
Tam could be a second measure for those things that can't necessarily read the taste from.
Come on, guys. Tell me, what must be true according to this? Come on, what is it?
Tom can't be an extra measure? Like if you, say even if it has to do fire, but the taste can't necessarily come out, so then it'd be, then you have the issue of Tom, where you have to wait still another 24 hours or so for the next day, to remove.
You're not answering my question.
What's the question? Wait, you guys...
My question is, if you think that Tom Ki Ikar is never biblical, then how could it be that the Torah requires you to kosher?
Why do we assume it's biblical? We follow it biblically?
It is a pasuk, right? That you need to kosher kelim.
Yeah, kosher. Fine. The act of koshering.
Good. So now answer the question.
So kik kosherim are daraita, but the tam we just said.
No, but I'm saying according to the shita, the tam ki ikar lav daraisa, meaning that the taste derived from pig is not prohibited on a biblical level.
Okay,
so then why would one ever need to kosher? Remember, right in our Gemara, the Gemara said what? The Gemara said, wait a second, if you all know in Tom Lifgam. So then, why do you ever need a kosher? And the Gemara's answer is, you're right, after 24 hours, fundamentally, you don't need a kosher. Right?
Right.
But now I'm asking you an even bigger kasha, which is, if you don't think that Tom is relevant biblically at all, because you paskin Tom ki ikar lav da'oraisa,
he might come to do it in an actual da'oraisa.
What case would be da'oraisa if Tom is not da'oraisa? Name me the case.
If the truth is actually there.
Right? If you assume it's paskin like Karbanos. If you assume it's paskin there. Right? But if you don't hold to this, when... Come on. Right? This is the big problem.
Doing Karbanos is day after day.
So, but if you think Tom is not problematic, so why is it a problem? Right? If you think Tom is never a problem,
the time itself is still awesome.
No, because Karbanos day after day doesn't matter. Tom is the same.
So, come on. What would you have to say? What has to be your conclusion? Come on.
Are we talking in terms of
Karbanos? I'm pushing you here. Get it. Come on.
You can't tovel it if it has treif in it. I don't know. I thought we had to connect it to...
Are we connecting this to Karbanos somehow?
Come on.
I'm not following.
Svara. Just give me logic. What must you say?
Why is such a problem that we don't find a deoraita for ta'am?
Because the Torah says you need to kosher.
That's koshering and there's ta'am. These are two different things.
If we have the concept
but if tam ki ikar lav da'oraisa, meaning the taste of prohibited substance is not usher, then why do you need a kosher kelim?
That is from the Gemara, from the Torah.
The Torah.
Okay, I'm just double checking that because I know
koshering is from the Torah.
Also correct. Okay, fine. Make sure.
No, this is the problem. Is if Tom is not from the Torah, then why would you have to kosher?
So Tom is for machloket whether it's in the Torah or not.
Right.
Okay.
That's the point. So if you hold like the Shita, which exists, that Tom is not D'oraisa. Not D'oraisa.
Okay, then what's the problem? You have to kosher.
Why?
Because D'oraisa goes over
the
Gemara says.
The Rabbanon have to kosher. The Rabbanon.
There's an act of kosher.
Okay, again, I'm going to try this again. If Tom is D'oraisa, then I understand koshering.
Well, how would that work?
Because if the taste of something prohibited is prohibited... Therefore, if you have a pot which was used to cook something not kosher, mid d'oraisa, if you then cook something else in that pot, the taste that is imparted from the pot back into that food will make that food biblically prohibited.
Correct.
Therefore, koshering makes sense, because koshering is the process by which we remove that taste.
Okay.
Right? But if you hold the tam ki ikar loved araisa, which is, meaning, the fact that when you cook pig in the pot, and then subsequently cook corn in the pot, and the corn now absorbs taste that tastes like pig, right? If you hold that that is biblically not problematic, because tam ki ikar lav da'areisa, that the notion that taste is prohibited in the same way that the pig itself was, so then why would one need to kasher?
Derabanan.
But it's not derabanan because kashering is from the psukim. So now, tell me. Explain, that's what I want you to explain, is if you hold that the transference of mere taste on a biblical level does not create a problem, then why biblically do you need a kasher?
But back on the biblical
level, why biblically do you need to kasher? That is the question.
There might not be just the taste, it might actually be some of the
action. No, because that's not koshering, right? Koshering is to remove taste. How do I know koshering is to remove taste?
It's the psukim.
How do you know it's not to remove that which is actually there? It's there to remove taste. How do I know?
Of course there would be stuff that's there.
And because, yes, and how do I know? Because Gemara said it's talking about something, right? The Gemara's whole question, which is koshering, is only relevant ben yomo. Because after ben yomo, the taste is rancid, which means we're only talking about taste. So how could it be that there exists a shita that taste biblically does nothing, and yet you still have to kosher? Isn't that a contradiction in terms? Right? No?
You don't need kosher, it wouldn't.
It's just talking about the substance rather than the taste. Maybe it's talking about this wacky case where the substance is gone but the taste is still there.
That's not wacky. It's a lot of anything. The pan right now smells that. Because
no, the pan. If there's no ounce of, let's say egg. There's no ounce of egg in it. Yet somehow, the pan imparts egg flavor into whatever you cook it.
Good, so what do you think? Come on. This is the million-dollar question that will help us understand Hesher Kalim. But what's the answer?
There's more to koshering than koshering.
What?
There's more to koshering than koshering.
Good. What is it?
It adds a
flavor.
I don't want to go into the Tova list of it.
But Sukkim is talking about Tzvila rather.
No. Yosef's on the right path. Nachum is not. Yosef, what are you saying? Good. This is what I wanted you to do. I wanted to force you into this corner.
Koshering puts something spiritual in it as opposed to just actual.
Remember I told you? Remember I said this in Tvila? Remember I told you in Tvila Kalim, right? That just like we're going to have Shitot that will bring Tvila more in line with Heksher, right? There will be the possibility that Heksher will be brought more in line with Tvila, right? Here is where you found it. It's this Shita, and this is what the Rav develops at length. Which is that the key to this is to understand that koshering is not only about
removing
taste. Clearly, right? It is about It is a halacha that one must take a kli which was used for not kosher and process it. Right? When the Gemara says here that if you don't kosher it, so it's not a problem. That's true. In terms of making the food treif, right? But in addition, the Rav argues, what you see is that there is a, right, just like there is tefila, there is this notion that that which belonged to a non-Jew has to go through a process which now makes it permitted to be used by a Jew. Koshering is the same. Now, you can formulate this in different ways. You can say that any kli that has a history of not kosherness needs to go through a process of koshering. You can say, right, the Rav has different formulations of this, that when we say that there's no that after 24 hours there's no tam, we don't mean there's no tam at all, right? We don't mean it's not problematic at all. We just mean that it's not enough to aser. But it's still there and still like problematic. It's just not sufficiently problematic to make it not kosher. Right? But it is problematic. Right? Like it does exist. Right? And therefore, ideally one must get rid of it. Right, you can have different formulations of this.
So that's only if you follow, like, if it's not deraita, the terms of time, If Tom is not a d'oraita, then the reason you have kashering is to help remove this goyness.
Or whatever, or the history of isserness, or whatever you want to call it, or the residual taste that maybe does exist, and the like. Now, the Rav said, where do you get a notion that this is true? Right? So he said, remember, what did the Gemara say? What exactly, right? The Gemara had a phrase and said, right, how do we know that new kalim need hechsher? How do you know new kalim need hechsher? Need tevilah. Maybe only old kalim need tevilah. What was the Gemara's answer? The Gemara's answer. This is a Gemara you have seen many times.
Isn't it that you're adding something?
The Gemara. Don't you say anything without quoting Gemara.
I thought I was quoting Gemara.
Gemara. What did the Gemara say? Right? This was in his Gemara.
I don't know. I'm not like you that know Gemara.
Then open your Gemara.
Oh, great. I don't have one.
Chadashim.
Chadashim.
Shanim v'libnan kichadashim damu. Because Gemara said, how do I know that new kalim need tevilah? Doesn't the Torah only talk about tevilah in the context of vessels which were used by the Midianites and therefore needed kashering and tevilah? And what was the Gemara's answer? No, because kashering is the equivalent of no. No!
Libun.
No! Because the process of kashering makes something like new halachically, and therefore, if we know that you need to tovel something that was kashered,
like hats,
then we know you need to double something which is new. But what did the Gemara swallow in that sentence?
That
the process of koshering isn't just the process of removing isser. What is it?
It's
the process of making the kli anew.
Wait, so then why would you have to pull it if you made it a new kli? Then it's like it made by a Jew.
Well, I assume the Gemara doesn't mean it really, right? But the Gemara is saying at some level it is giving it newness, right? It is making a new such that we could know legally. From the fact that you need to be tovel kalim that you got from a non-Jew and koshered, that you also need to tovel brand new kalim, because koshering makes something almost new. Right? What does that tell you? Right? The Gemara is saying that there is a status change. Right? Koshering isn't just removing isser. Right? The process of koshering halachically is the process of making a kli anew. Right? Which means, so, and again, from here, the Rav derives. Now he points that he's not the first person to. Now he says, "Where did I get this from?" Right, he notes that in the Yotzer of Shabbos Hagadol, right, one of the Tfilot. I'll come back to that question. He notes, now, what might be nafkaminas of these types of things? Right, so he notes, one type of nafkamina might be, is there a lechatchila to not kosher and just buy a new kli? Right? Is that a lechatchila?
Sometimes, yeah. Well, that's more of the idea of the non-stick coating.
Is, fundamentally, like, is it better to have Pesach kelim? Like most of us do, yeah. Or is it better to kosher?
And clearly, if most of us have Pesach kelim, then it's a good, better thing.
No, it could just be it's easier because we're all wealthy, right? By historical standards, right?
One better than the other. They're both your kelim.
Because how much do you think that koshering, right? If you think that koshering just permits something, right? You might think, well, permitting something is not as good as getting a new kli, but if you think, no, it's equivalent to making it new, there'd be no different. I mean, you understand that the exact way you understand it is going to have nafkaminas. But let me throw out, now, the reason I think this is the most important is because of something I hope we'll get to, which is, could you argue that you need koshering even for something that doesn't absorb ta'am?
Like,
Like stainless steel, like all of your kalim.
Those do absorb.
No, they don't. No, they don't. Scientifically, they do not.
Then why do you have to the name stainless?
Then why are they designated to one sort of thing, eager milk?
Oh, and that is exactly the question, right? So, you could say, well, stainless, right? One could construct a theoretical argument and say, well, all the halakha of the Gemara don't apply nowadays because we deal with stainless steel, and stainless steel doesn't absorb, and therefore you can use, as long as it's clean, you could use your stainless steel for meat and then milk, or for kosher or not kosher, right? You
well,
could.
Is it a Mars Iron issue?
No. Or you could argue what? Now you could deny the science, right? You could deny the science. You could. There are a lot of models you could do, or you could do. I'm saying this because these are actual arguments that Poskim have made. Or you could say, look, maybe we'll be makel post facto, and say if you accidentally cooked in a stainless steel pot milk and then meat, maybe. We could be makel and say it's not, even if it's within 24 hours, it's still kosher because there was no ta'am absorbed. But you still have to kosher it because koshering is about more than just removing absorption of taste. It's a formal halakhic process that which was used for not kosher must now go through the process of koshering in order to be used l'chatchila. And therefore one could come up with an argument, and Rav Malamud actually does. Right? One second. Rav Malamud actually comes up with this argument. I said, we're not going to get through everything in extra kalim, which is why I want to sort of set up principles that are going to help you, you know, deal with whatever shadows we get, and maybe understanding this again in the future. Rav Malamud Lemaisa, right, sets up an argument similar to the one I just constructed, which is that nowadays stainless steel kalim, even ben yomo, right, even within 24 hours, if you accidentally use a clean pot for meat and then milk, or milk and then meat, right, the food will be kosher because we know scientifically that this pot doesn't absorb. But he would still tell you that you need to kosher the pot if it was used for not kosher or used for milk and meat, because he's compelled, he quotes the Rav, he's compelled by the Rav's argument that Hechsher Kalim is not only about removing the problem, and therefore potentially one could be required to kosher a kli even in a circumstance in which there is an absorption. Right? Again, this is just an introduction to Hechsher Kalim. Right? Is that now just to point out. The simplest read of Hechsher Kalim is that what is Hechsher Kalim? It's the process of removing problematic taste. Right? And 90% of Hechsher Kalim really is about that. Right? It really is about that. That's really what it is. Right? And then you have to, you know, again, we're going to have to get into as much as we can the details of it. Is it removing all the taste? Is it removing enough of the taste? Does that mean there's no taste there before? Is there a weak taste? Or etc. Right? And then you have to draw distinctions between Hechsher, between Libun and Hagala. Right? Meaning, are Libun and Hagala the same? But clearly they're both kosher, but do they kosher in the same way? Right? Is it just two ways of doing the same thing for different types of kalim? Or do they kosher in different ways fundamentally? Right? And you see formulations in Rishonim like this, that maybe Hagala removes taste, and Hechsher and Libun burns taste. Right? There may be a difference. Right? As we'll see. But what I want you to keep in mind is that while 90% of Hechsher is about removing taste, right? The existence of the Shita, that Tam Kikar La the Araisa, that Tam is irrelevant halachically on a biblical level, juxtaposed to the reality that, in the way Chazal understand it, Hechsher Kalim is the Araisa, generates almost inescapably the position that Hechsher does something more than merely remove taste, right? But rather, I don't know if you want to call it adds kedusha or puts the pot through a process that is necessary, right? It's the act by which we remove non-kosherness, right? Like in a fundamental way, right? That shita opens up the possibility, right? That Hechsher is not only about removing taste. And therefore provides us an opening, again, like I said, these are actual shita that exist in the world. This is not theoretical, right? That even when we're dealing with substances that do not absorb taste, like stainless steel, right, Hechsher may still be necessary.
So we don't care about taste, we just...
Again, this is a potential construct, and like I said, I wish we had several weeks on Hechsher Kalim, because then we could flesh out each of these each of these things. But today, I just wanted to give you a basic introduction to this. I'm trying to find the specific quote from the Rav uses to prove this point.
So our main goal is not to necessarily get rid of taste or the substance. It's just.
I didn't say primarily. I said not. Not exclusively. Not exclusively. I think it's spiritual, or you know, we could go in different ways with this.
If you're going to say that, because Matan is something that isn't deraita, then why would you have hechsher in the room? And you would say it's because there's more to it than just the actual room of
taste.
I'm still wondering why stainless steel, if it doesn't absorb, why is there an issue of designating it for meat and milk? You don't use it together.
No,
you can use
it
for. One time for meat.
And that is why I'm trying to open up the sugya, because this is one of those major questions. Now again, there are other ways you could do it. You could say that halacha denies science, right? That is a model that is in fact taken, or that it's irrelevant irrelevant for halacha, that once the halacha has been decided, even if the reality has changes, we have to follow it. Formally, right? There are all types of ways that you can. There are all types of ways that we could formulate this. Where is this quote? I don't know why this is not. I can't find it. Probably is as many pieces in which he. Let's see. If I can't find it in a minute, then I'll bring it for you tomorrow. I'm gonna have to get the pass out. Okay, you know what? We'll come back to this tomorrow, okay? Tomorrow we'll try to get through this the sugya a little bit more. Again, we'll see how much we actually get through. But that at least I think is an introduction to try to get you thinking about the complexity in the sugya, okay?